Well, it's good to be here. You know, as our health goes, it's good to be anywhere, right? And I see that Terry and Maggie are here. They were here last week. Didn't I see you last week? Tushy, yeah. I used to know her in high school, but they called her Margie. Yeah. And her brother Richard was there too. I mean, he was in my class. You must have been in a following up. Yeah. Yeah, the last name was Moat then. Not Smote, Moat. Yes, it was good to see everybody here. And today we'll be talking about Jesus. Let's show some pictures, too, here.
Oops. Oh, no. We have the wrong file.
Oh.
We have the one without your slides.
Uh-oh. Yeah. I was telling Keith there that we need to have it so we can plug in up here. Maybe someday. Yeah, I had a lot of pictures. I thought I'd start out reading a quote from Ellen White. And what I'm presenting is a series, it's part of a series, and we'll get it right next week. And part of a series on the life of Christ and the future. In other words, great controversy theme all the way through. Now, this is what Ellen White has to say. We have nothing to fear for the future except as we shall forget the way the Lord has led us and his teachings in our past history. I believe that is a very important statement. The Bible is all history, except for some prophecies about the future, but even the prophecies were made back in history. And today I'd like to talk about some of those. And history is extremely important. I had a professor in college. He was my major professor. Interesting guy. He had two doctorate degrees in church history. And the way that happened, he took one of them in Denmark. He spoke Danish. He took one of them in Denmark, wrote about the Sabbath, the history of the Sabbath, and they wouldn't give him his doctorate degree. So he went over to England and started over and got his doctorate degree. And then over in Denmark, they said, you know, his research really was good. There was nothing wrong with it. So they gave him a doctorate degree. He was my advisor in college and later became the president of La Sierra and Loma Linda Universities. We have here, and he would say, that Christianity is a historical religion. Christianity is a historical religion. You can't get around it. All from the beginning of Genesis all the way through Revelation, and I was telling people a little while ago that it is amazing how Ellen White covered all that in the books she wrote, the Conflict of the Ages series, Patriarchs and Prophets through Great Controversy. No one else in the world did that. I've never seen anything like it. Her alone. Now, beginning in Isaiah 53, I'm going to read a text here. It says, he has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Young Jesus. And it's also said, behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. It's clear back in Isaiah. When did Isaiah write? Isaiah wrote before 700 BC. It's amazing how these prophecies come from so many years ago, and yet they're so accurate. The life of Jesus. The next one here is Babylon, going back into some history. Why Babylon? What am I? You're talking about Jesus. Well, God was setting up a plan. He had a plan to set up the world for the coming of Jesus. And so Babylon was a great empire. And you remember Nebuchadnezzar, his father, Nabopolassar, that started this whole thing back about 626 B.C. And it went down to about 528 B.C. Now, the reason God wanted Babylon is to punish Israel for their worship of idols, other gods, unfaithfulness to him. And he told them through Jeremiah and Isaiah, hey, you're going to be punished. And so Babylon did come on the scene and did punish Israel, didn't they? I think the last attack on the city of Jerusalem was about 586, 585 B.C. And it was pretty severe punishment. Then, coming later on, about 550 B.C., and I don't know if I've spoken here before about Cyrus, but Cyrus was a tremendous worker for God. Believe that or not. His life was led, his birth, his upbringing, everything was predicted in the scriptures. Then when he came on the scene, he comes down and he starts the Medo-Persian Empire. They move into Babylon. And when he entered the city of Babylon, if you can picture this in your mind, I have all these pictures, but we won't have them today. You can imagine coming into Babylon, and the people are lined up on both sides of the streets, and they're cheering as he conquered the city. Can you imagine being cheering for somebody that just conquered your city? And the reason they were cheering is because Cyrus, they knew Cyrus and his reputation, that he believed in religious freedom. And God set it up, set Cyrus up, so that he would come in and give the command to go back and rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. God had a plan. The next one online was Greece. And you remember, Greece was extensive, clear from India out to Greece. And it was a large empire. And if you go back and read the history of Alexander the Great, you'll see that God protected Alexander. God was leading Alexander. If you've read the history on some of his, he attacked, his first attack, an amazing Persian army. It was just a tremendous army of hundreds of thousands. And his army was on that side of the river, and he entered the river with his soldiers out there first and attacked the army out in front. One time over in India, he even went up. They were attacking a city, and his soldiers were astounded. He was up on the wall before anybody else attacking the city. That's when he got wounded. He thought he would never die. He thought he was a god almost. But anyhow, God put this great empire of Greece in there for one purpose. What was that purpose? Can you imagine? The language. And that language became the language that even the apostles wrote the New Testament in. It was so popular, so large. Even the people in the West who spoke Latin, the educated people, could read Greek. I don't know if you know this or not, but about 220 B.C., there was a guy by the name of Ptolemy II. Of course, his dad was one of Alexander's generals. He called 72 men down to Egypt to put together a Bible. And that Bible, the Septuagint, was extremely important. That Bible was spread all around that empire. You know what Paul quoted from? When Paul quoted, he quoted from the Septuagint. I still keep it on my tablet today and occasionally refer back to the Septuagint. And so God provided one language that the message could go out in. Then after the Greeks, who came on the scene? Then the Romans hit, didn't they? Before the Greeks. And so the Romans came in about 158 BC, and they made this tremendous empire. And you've seen maps of it, haven't you? All around from England down to Spain and Portugal and all around the Mediterranean, the Middle East and North Africa, the whole Mediterranean was under control of the Romans. Well, what did that mean for the gospel? It meant this. You could travel by boat without the pirates and the attacks because the Roman army was out there with their ships cleaning these guys out of the way. Not only that, but if you've ever seen, I don't have the picture here, but if you've ever seen their road system, they had a road system you wouldn't believe. And you could cross clear from Israel out to France or Spain, and there were no borders. Nobody was going to stop you, except there were a few thieves along the way occasionally. But it was a tremendous way for the gospel to go to the then known world, to have all that transportation. Well, this is how God led. Now, Israel, if you can picture Israel, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, of course, and up way far in the north by the Sea of Galilee was the home of Joseph and Mary. And they traveled down to Bethlehem. Where was Bethlehem? Bethlehem, actually today, if you go over there and you look at a map, there's one field or two between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. You know, they're that close. It would be close to, saying, Walla Walla and College Place. And so they went down there to Bethlehem. Was that seen ahead of time? You just read the verses about Rachel weeping for her children. That was a prophecy also. As they were coming in, that is, Rachel and Jacob coming down from the north. They were coming from the north. They passed Jerusalem. They got into the north side of what today is Bethlehem. And she gave birth right there on the road. Benjamin was born. It was a hard birth. And she was crying. And that weeping, I think, in the prophecy would be, if you go back to her time, that weeping would be that she was weeping for her two boys that would be born and not have a mother. But it also is used by the New Testament writers saying it's a prophecy about the destruction of the children in Bethlehem. And I think it many of these have a dual application. We only give them a dual application when another inspired writer gives it a second application. I wish a lot of people who believed in the rapture and some of these end time theories would believe that. You only give the second application if an inspired writer gives that application. I include Ellen White in that too. Well, they moved down. Joseph and Mary went down to Bethlehem, and the route usually was to go a little bit east, follow the river all the way down, and then up into Jerusalem. That was a normal route. It was an easy route, flat, and they didn't have to go through Samaria. Samaritans and the Jews weren't, you know how that was. I've lived in countries where there was animosity between cultures. We have a lot of that in this country too. And it's culture. It's a culture war. It's a culture shock. And I could tell you stories down in South America where these little These little fat ladies with the bolo hat, they called them cholitas. And twice I was hit, two or three times, hit hard, just run into me. So they have a culture problem down there too. But getting down there to, they got down there to Bethlehem, of course, and it said that who was trying to kill the babies? Herod the Great. His I was going to say empire, but his country, because he was a like a state, and he was the governor, but it was big. It went clear up above Jesus and round toward the east, past the Sea of Galilee. It was a big place. He was an important man. But we also read in history that he killed a lot of people. You can read some of that with Josephus. And he was a bloody person. Well, that's why it says here, you Bethlehem, though you be among the thousands of Judah, out of you shall come forth to me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from everlasting. Yeah, from old. Well, there is. It says in Matthew chapter 2, he says, it's also in Jeremiah 31, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. I don't know how many he killed, but there were quite a few that he slaughtered there. Now, just get back up into Galilee. You know that Jesus went down to Egypt, and nobody knows how long he was in Egypt. They're not sure. There are different accounts. People come up with different figures. But he did come back. And by the age of 12, we know he was down in Jerusalem. And he's, you remember, went into the temple there and surprised the leaders with how much he knew.
Well, when Herod died, that's when they were told they could come back. So that's when we would know.
Well, when was Jesus born, by the way? Around, yeah, some say 3, 4, but he was about 4 B.C. Therefore, 27 A.D. makes sense that he appeared as the Messiah to start his ministry because you had to be 30 years old to be accepted as a teacher. Well, Galilee, if you get looking at Galilee where he lived, and I'm talking a lot about the background of Jesus' life, if you were to look at Galilee, it would look greener than it does here in the springtime, if you can imagine. Trees, grass, flowers, beautiful place.
Year-round?
I don't know if it was year-round. I think it did dry out a little bit. And then he lived right on the plain of Jezreel. You know, Nazareth is up here. There's the plain of Jezreel on the other side. There was Megiddo over there, the city of Megiddo. And then up on, what was the mountain there?
Mount Tabor.
We call it Mount Megiddo today, too, because it was right by Megiddo. And anyhow, this was the life of Jesus. And nearby, real close by, like from College Place to Walla Walla again, where he lived. See, they lived on a hill. Nazareth was kind of on the side of a hill. But there was a city bigger, just to the northwest, called Sepphoris. And this was an old city. Some say it goes clear back to the time of the flood, or just after the flood. It was a very old city. And it was Hellenistic at the time of Jesus. What does that mean? The Greeks had their influence there, and they had Roman architecture, and they had their arena, you know, where they would put on their shows. Where do they get the word arena? sand. What's the word in Spanish? Arena. Arena in Latin. But that's where they get the word arena, because they always had sand down there. But anyhow, they had all these things there, and I had various pictures of this great city of Sepphoris. Now, it is thought that Jesus' mother was born there, and her sister. And so, it's a city on the hill. Does that ring a bell? A city on a hill cannot be hidden. I wonder if Jesus was thinking of that city on the hill near his town that he had looked at in his childhood. It's amazing that he was there for 27 years working, and he learned using his hands. Today, when educated people think that is a terrible thing, that you have to work with your hands. A lot of people think that's the lowest, as low as you can go. And I believe that's what Jesus is trying to tell us, that that is good. People learn that today, maybe they'd stay out of trouble a little bit. Get to work. Near Jesus, if you went a little bit to the east, you run into the Sea of Galilee. Now, around the Sea of Galilee, you had towns that were very, very famous. Capernaum, you remember? What other towns were there? Magdala? Yeah. Various towns that are mentioned in Scripture. They weren't very far from Jesus' home. And there were towns like Nain, just a few miles away, about 4 miles away, and he was there. So this is where Jesus grew up, and I can imagine as he grew up, he could look out, he could probably see the Sea of Galilee. Now the Sea of Galilee is, they call it a sea, it's really a lake, isn't it? It's a lake, kind of a long lake, and they tell us it's nearly 700 feet below sea level. It's that would seem like that would become like the Dead Sea, you know, all salt. But there were a lot of rivers going in and out of there. This is where Jesus lived. And he goes down there to Capernaum, for example, and he goes to places that Peter and John and James lived. There, you can go there today, and they claim that they have their houses, and we can go to this house. They claim you can go down to Bethlehem and see the exact place where Jesus was born, but they've just chosen something and put up something. Did you notice that the Christians couldn't even get in there this year? The Christians always go to these holy places, you know, like where Jesus was born. Couldn't get in there this year because of the war going on. Well, as I move along here, I'm going to read Luke. It says, then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them, his parents. That's what kids need to learn today, too. But his mother kept all these things in her heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Jesus, his family is an interesting situation too. Mary was quite a bit younger than Joseph. Everybody knows that. How many brothers did Jesus have?
It says four. We were reading about there.
Okay, there was James and Joseph and Simon and Judah. Two of these were very famous in the New Testament, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Which ones? James and Judas. Wrote the James was supposedly the leader of the church. You get into the first chapter of Galatians, it talks about him being the brother of Jesus. And in Acts, it mentions that James was the one who would pronounce whatever decision the group made. He was in charge. In fact, he even called Peter on the carpet one time for eating with the Gentiles. Remember that? I thought Peter was the first pope. Doesn't make sense there, does it? How about he was You wouldn't call the Pope on the carpet and condemn him for eating with the Gentiles. Say, explain yourself. Well, anyhow, I don't know how many sisters Jesus had. It just says he had sisters. If he had as many sisters as he did brothers, that would make, what, 9 children total? A big family.
No,
you don't know how many of these children were Mary's.
Really, Joseph had kids before. Wouldn't they be with them when they're doing all this traveling?
Now, it's interesting. You know, one interesting thing, if she had so many children, when Jesus died on the cross, he looks at John and says, John, your mother. In other words, you're going to take care of my mother. But she had all these children. She must, maybe, I don't know. He knew the future. John was young. Maybe that was it. He was very young.
And Ellen White says that every time John was around Mary, it reminded him of Jesus. You know, they were so close.
Yeah, very close to Jesus. Now, when I go through the prophecies, and I look at the prophecies about Jesus, you know what our evangelists do in their first sermons? What are they? Usually Daniel 2, Daniel 7, you know, Daniel 8. Why do they do that?
Get people's attention to the end of the world.
Well, what they're doing is they're trying to establish faith in the scriptures. You see these prophecies fulfilled. People today do not have faith in the Word of God. And so that's a good practice. The hardest thing today is to teach people that there is even a God. You got to start there now. How do you know there's a God? So you have to go back and discuss evolution, creation, and establish the fact that maybe there is a God. Don't want to get into that. That's a big subject. That's another day. But the prophecies that I like to start with sometimes and starting to talk to people and get their faith in the scriptures, first of all, here's one in Zechariah. Well, it says, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. I won't use the word that King James uses. And that is one of the precise prophecies about Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. How could that be by chance? Another one. Zechariah 11, then I said to them, if it is agreeable to you, give me my wages, and if not, refrain. So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. And then what does it say? It says that they took the 30 pieces of silver and went out and bought a field to bury strangers in. But this is clear back in Zechariah. Matthew made a mistake. He said it was Jeremiah. But it's Zechariah. It just tells you that we don't believe in verbal inspiration. We believe in thought inspiration. The words were the words of Matthew, the words of John, the words of Luke. They were not, every word wasn't chosen by God and put into their pen, right? It's a thought inspiration. That's important. Now we, other passages. It says, that one in Zechariah says, throw it to the potter, the price they set on me. Then, in Isaiah 53, he was oppressed. He was afflicted. He did not open his mouth. See, doesn't that sound like his trial? He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before the shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Then he says, he guards all his bones, and not one of them is broken. That's out of Psalms. All these I'm reading are from the Old Testament. If you can do these comparisons with people, if you're going to go study the Bible with somebody, use these. Give them confidence in the Bible and in the story of Jesus. And another one in Isaiah 53, but he was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I mean, how precise can you be? I like all of these. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people was he stricken. You remember reading these a lot, right? It talks about his death. It talks about being buried in a tomb of a rich man. Now, did Jesus have control over these? I had a professor in college, in the same college, and he said, oh, by the way, he went to Chicago and got his doctorate in Chicago. And he says, God only knows the future because he knows what he's going to cause. And I said, well, that's interesting. That means that if he knew all about the death of his son, he killed his own son? No, I don't believe that. God knows the future. Period.
Gives us freedom of choice.
Yeah. In Psalms 22, it says that divided his garments among them and cast lots. And it says also, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Psalms 22:1. Now, the biggest one of all comes out of Daniel, the 9th chapter. And I'm not going to go through the study of the 2,300 days and the 70 weeks, but most Christians believe that the time of Jesus' baptism was predicted in Daniel. Where they disagree is they think that the last week of that 70-week prophecy is thrown down at the end of time. Of course, no Bible writer says that. They just do it. That's where your rules of interpreting Scripture are important. And Adventists have good rules for interpreting Scripture. But if you think about that, this prophecy that started in 457 B.C. and goes down to 27 A.D. when he would be baptized, anointed, it says. That's pretty precise, even the time of year, the fall of the year. Then, in the midst of the week, he would be cut off. In other words, half of 7 years go by, right? Each day is a year. Half of those 7 years go by, and in the midst he was cut off. That brings you to the spring of 31 AD. Not only that, he was called the Passover Lamb. They were sacrificing the Passover Lamb at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When Jesus died, the curtain was ripped from top to bottom in the temple. I wonder what the priests thought. They had to come in the next day and serve there. And here's the holy place open. 4-inch thick curtain. Various layers. But it happened. How precise is that? Down to the second? Now, what's the chance that that could happen by accident? What is the chance that Jesus caused all these things to happen because he wanted to be the Messiah? Buried in a rich man's tomb, ripped in the curtain in the temple, all the things, you know, parting his garments, all these things done, his betrayal. It even says in the Old Testament he'd be betrayed by a friend. But if you're studying with somebody, go through all of these prophecies and give them complete confidence that the Bible is real. It is from God. Now, let me say this. The disciples went through all this searching of the Scriptures after Jesus died. They weren't sure about things when he died. They weren't even sure he was resurrected. They didn't quite believe the women that came running from the tomb. But they went searching through the Scriptures, and they went all through these Scriptures we talked about. And how convinced were they that they had to get the message out to the world? Only Judas died of his own hand. James, they say, died of a sword down in Judea. Peter, they say, was crucified upside down. Even Ellen White says that. That's tradition, by the way. We get that from tradition. Paul was beheaded in Rome. Andrew was crucified in Russia, they say. Thomas died of a spear in India. Philip, tortured. Finally, he died. Matthew was stabbed in Ethiopia, they said. Bartholomew killed in Arabia. James stoned and clubbed to death in Syria. Simon killed in Persia. Matthias was beheaded and burned in Syria. John in Ephesus, he died of old age, the only one. But he was thrown into boiling oil, according to tradition. I could talk about that thing about tradition. We'll do that later. Do we believe in some tradition? Yeah. It's just history. But we don't establish any of our beliefs on tradition. None of our practices come out of tradition. Well, anyhow, as I went through this and I thought about it, they witnessed the resurrection of Jesus. Think about that. Think about seeing somebody walking around that was dead. They had faith in the second coming of Jesus because of all these prophecies being fulfilled and because they knew Jesus personally and they knew that he was going to return. Now, the question is here, how strong is your faith? Has this changed your life? Do you have enough faith in the second coming of Jesus to change some of your practices? What are we doing during the week? What's our prayer life like? What's our Bible study like? What is occupying our time? Do we believe enough in the second coming of Jesus to make these changes?